Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
All right, welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? And this is going to be entitled Josh's Big Adventure. Hello there, Josh. Fresh back, sort of, from Ireland.
Yeah, I think I'm finally over the jet lag, over a week later.
And we have also, of course, the irreplaceable Red Pill Junkie.
Top of the morning to you. But that's kind of like my best Irish impersonation, which I will not repeat.
The Mexican Leprechaun. That's your new
luchador. Ooh, there we go.
That's your luchador alter ego.
All right. So, Josh, you took a trip to Ireland and played with the fairies.
I guess so. I tried to be a good playmate, but I don't know how far we got. Yeah, I went from the 26th of September. From the 27th of September through the 6th of October. Basically around the coast from Dublin to Belfast up to County Antrim. Spent a quick moment in Sligo, down to Galway, then down to Dingle, across to Limerick, Lough Gur, and then on back over to Dublin. So missed about the bottom, somewhere between the bottom third, maybe, of the country, but saw a lot of it, and it was exhausting, but I feel like it helped me really contextualize and wrap my head around some things.
Such as?
Basically how fairy forts are, you know, sort of a dime a dozen, and I never thought that I would become desensitized to seeing them, but, you know, I was after a while. You know, I've remarked multiple times that I'm incredibly surprised that no one has tried to, no enterprising grad student has ever tried to, sort of charge keep a them. Running tally. Yeah, exactly. Keep a running tally. But the other thing that was interesting is just to see, like, to see how it's a bit like, what was that Supreme Court justice ruling? You know, I don't know how to define pornography, but I know it when I see it. You know, I don't know how to define a fairy fort, but I know it when I see it, which isn't entirely true. But I saw fairy forts of, different descriptions, different sort of makeups in different transitory stages in between. And to see that really helped me wrap my head around what it means when you read these legends about, the kid played in the fairy fort, or the kid played on the fairy mound, or, you know, on the fairy wrath. Hearing those things and seeing it gave me some sort of context for that sort of thing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, why don't you explain to people a little about what fairy forts are?
Well, so that's exactly what I was going to get into too, is that it also helped me, realize, how there is nothing, really ambiguous about where these have come from. You know, in my mind, it was always like, yeah, well, some of them are early, you know, early human dwellings, and maybe some of them are a little bit more mysterious. No, they're pretty much all, Neolithic or early Christian constructions. You'll find a couple of different types. The first type is, and again, there's a sort of vague conflation, but you've got the fairy mounds, which are usually like burial mounds that we'd be familiar with in America, or earthworks. All these different types are generally, avoided even to this day by people, and there are some accounts of people, you know, just like in Iceland, rerouting construction projects around them. But you have fairy mounds, and then you have the first type of fairy fort that I was able to positively identify was a ring of stones About 1 to 2 stones deep and 1 stone high. So really just basically a very basic ring, almost like, you know, when you're making a fire, but in a very large setting, you know, about, you know, half an acre or so. That in the middle is just completely covered in trees. And what's interesting about these fairy forts is that there are other, you know, little groves that you'll find in cow pastures, but they will usually have some sort of passage that the cows have been, you know, sort of tromping through. But on these fairy forts, you don't see that. They're pretty much untouched, from what I could tell. Then you have forts that are a little bit more substantial, and these are what, you know, are definitely ring forts, because they're about, you know, they're usually at least chest high, and they're made up of stacked stone in that traditional sort of Irish style. I remember, I think I did some research while I was there. Not only are there more sheep than people in Ireland, but there are, I believe, 27,000 miles of stone walls on an island that's the size of Indiana, you know. Also, the estimates for fairy forts are between 40 and 60,000, again, in that same sort of space. So you'd think that you'd be tripping over them, and that's probably part of the reason that a lot of the people I talked to were sort of blasé about them. But these fairy, the ring forts is what I'm talking about now, these sort of stacked stone structures, which are usually, they're actually surprisingly intricate. The concentric ring structures within a larger outer wall. Sometimes there will be several inner rings as well. These, by the way, I took videos of every different type that I ran across, so they're going to be sharing them on the Where Did the Road Go with Patreons. I've just got to edit them together, find a free minute to do that. And then sort of the last two that I was able to see are, you know, earthen mounds, a very tall, I mean, I think this one that I was at was... 15 feet tall, with an inner depression, and then an inner ring on the other side. So you can actually do an entire circle of the ring fort in between these two 15-foot, you know, earthworks. Which sometimes they're earthworks, sometimes they're actually the stacked stone that over the years has been covered with moss and vegetation and you know, actually the actual, you know, the sod itself. And then there's another type that, you know, that you'll see. Is a ring of trees around an outer circle, and then a depression, sort of a trough, and then an inner circle as well. It's more like an inner mound. So I think that, I mean, honestly, that would be a dream project for me, and I don't know if anybody's done it, but I haven't run across it. It's just sort of cataloging and like really describing the different themes that you see with these ring forts. And of course it makes sense that they come in, you know, varying shapes and sizes, because they were made by different cultures. Like I said, some of them were Neolithic, absolutely ancient, and some of them are, you know, just early Christian, which still means about, you know, the year 600 or 700, I think. But it was quite startling to have read about this sort of thing your entire life, and then to actually be, you know, confronted with it.
Okay. What, I mean, these are not structures that there's any mystery about how they were built, but why are they built, do you think?
Right. So that's,
and why are there so many of them?
Right. So that's part of what really helped me conceptualize it is, you know, being someone who is, you know, sort of a staunch advocate of some sort of objective reality of the fairy faith. I was wondering why, you know, there is all this lore surrounding these things that are very obviously human constructs. And I heard someone describe it to me as the idea that after these ancient peoples moved out, the fairies moved into these places, which I think is in some ways a lot more interesting in terms of what it raises about connections between the fairies and the dead, the connections that it raises about, you know, were these special spots that ancient people found, or were the spots made special by, you know, by their habitation there? But some of them were dwelling sites. Some of them were undoubtedly ritual sites. In fact, there's a stone circle that I went to that almost had this sort of outer mound beyond the stone circle that almost sort of function like, you know, bleachers, if you will. Mm-hmm. And there is also evidence that they were used to house livestock to protect them at night. Because, you know, I believe it was 4,000 years ago that the last bears died in Ireland, something like that. And, you know, a lot of these structures, like, for example, around Loch Gur, there are plenty of ring circles and whatnot. And that's an area that's been inhabited continuously for 8,000 years, which is just it's a staggering amount of time for someone from America. Not that we didn't have indigenous peoples, but they didn't necessarily leave that sort of, you know, permanent mark on the landscape quite like this.
Well, I don't know. They did. A lot of it was taken out. Look at the whole mound culture and then in the Midwest.
True, but those I think, I mean, do we have 60,000 burial mounds in America? I mean, I guess we probably do.
But the thing is, so much of it was destroyed too.
That's also true. That's also true. You know, I think that there's also some evidence that more modern man has used those ring forts for that similar purpose. But for the most part, the ones that I saw were untouched. I really hoped and expected to see a lot more, but I found out very quickly that between the hedges that are constantly obscuring your view and the fact that they are difficult to see at eye level because, you know, you don't have a real sense of perspective unless you go up to them, it's kind of difficult to catch them from the road, especially if you're, you know, trying to go someplace, trying to get someplace quickly. But after some time, you'd see something and be like, yep, that's another one. And you'd be able to sort of get a feel for what they look like. And again, I'm sure that I saw many more than I even recognized simply because I was too distracted by how, you know, utterly gorgeous this countryside is.
Okay. You describe what they look like, but what about what they feel like? What is it like to be inside one of those?
So if they were sites that were obviously very well traveled by people, or they were clearer, I actually did make it a point to go into a few. But I made it also a point at every bed and breakfast that we stayed at to shove my jacket pockets full of full of bread or, like, you know, sweets and whatnot. You know, it's not James Boyd, a good friend of mine, 14 of the highest caliber, was riding me as I was there and be like, an entire loaf of bread works quite well. And I'm like, dude, I gotta, you know, I'm on the move here. So I definitely made sure to grab some stuff to leave behind, because I didn't want anything to be misconstrued as disrespect. You know, it's interesting. The first fort that I found was the one that made the greatest impression on me, and it's also the one that I didn't enter. It was one of the ones with the smaller ring of rocks with the grove inside. And standing on the edge of it, it was so uncanny. And hopefully this comes across in the video a little bit, but, you know, we had great weather while we were there, and it was this bright, beautiful, sunshiny day in Ireland. Everything around you is this, like, I've never seen so many shades of green, and literally, you know, 2 feet in front of me within this circle is the densest, darkest, sickliest, pale, grove of trees, you know, these skinny, pale skinny, pale trunks that are all clustered really tightly together. I mean, I honestly don't know if I had decided to go in how far in I would get because it was so densely clustered. I definitely got the sense with that one that there is something, you know, still hanging around there. Some of the other ones that were a little bit more touristy oriented or that had had more foot traffic, you could just go up and you could just tell that it was, you know, there really wasn't anybody at home. Those weren't necessarily the only sites where I got, you know, some sort of feeling. Around Lough Gur, which is where we spent the time in County Limerick, it's that site that has been inhabited for 8,000 years. There's just an embarrassment of riches. And it's one of those places that I don't think a lot of people know to go because it's not, you know, as popular. But you're dealing with, you know, there, and we can talk about this more later, you're dealing with just, you know, I stood in the largest stone circle in Ireland, 400 years older than Stonehenge by current estimations. And the guy that we'd hired for the day was saying, oh yeah, you know, they're about, you know, 15 more within a mile radius of here, or, you know, within a kilometer of here. You know, it's just, it's incredible. But some of those other sites, some of the other megalithic sites around Lough Gur, felt a little bit more active, whatever that means to you, than a lot of the fairy forts, which really surprised me. For example, there was a megalithic tomb that was broken open long ago, but we went there at, you know, 10 p.m. and that by far was the creepiest place that we went, you know, after the ferry fort, in terms of just getting a real, you know, sense of the willies there.
So did anything
you
weird
went
actually
there at 10 p.m.?
Yeah. So my goal initially was to, you know, I was talking to my wife. I'm like, I'm going to go out at 3 a.m. and it's going to be great. We're going to, you know, we're going to stand out there. We're going to hang out for like, you know, an hour and a half. And it gets to be about 9 p.m. and you're like, I don't know if I can do this. You know, this is on day next, the next to last day of the vacation. And, you know, you're just exhausted from running around. You know, I think we averaged about 15 or between 15 and 20,000 steps a day. And like at least a quarter, if not more of those were like straight uphill. So it was nothing leisurely about this vacation. So you get to 9 p.m. and you're like, yeah, I think we're going to go out early. So around Loch Gur, I did go to, let's see, four different sites at night. I went to Carrigal, which is a series of two concentric close by ring forts that overlook the loch. I went to the shores of the loch because one of the two hills there is Knock Fennel, which has a cave that I didn't get to see. Womp womp. A cave that is supposedly one of four entrances to Tir na n'Og in Ireland. Went to the megalithic tomb, which is known as the Giant's Tomb, and also spent some time in the Stone Circle. Now, did you ask me, Soraya, if anything strange happened
yes.
at all?
Yes.
So the Stone Circle. Every time I talk about this, it gets a little bit weirder. So we had hired, through the wonderful insight of my wife, hired a private tour guide from the history center there, who was actually an elderly gentleman in his 80s, very spry, and also one of the founding forces there at Loch Gur in terms of creating the visitor center, the cultural heritage center there. A local who also you know, went back to school just to get his archaeology master's, you know, later in life. An incredible, very, very well, very, very well, learned man, name of, Michael Quinlan, I believe. And, he talked to us for a while in the Stone Circle. He talked to us for about 45 minutes in the middle of 2 p.m. Again, the largest stone circle in Ireland, 400 years older than Stonehenge, 2 p.m. It's just me and my wife and this guy. If that gives you an idea of how, you know, not well trafficked this particular area is, not to say that we hadn't seen tour buses there in the past, but. You know, earlier in the day, but at that moment it was completely, completely empty besides the three of us. And he was speaking to us about, you know, very, very, well-reasoned, evidence-based estimations for how they sort of guess the age of the site, through archaeology. It's 150 stones. Sorry. Is that right? Is it 150 stones? It's 150 feet across. And it is, it's 150 feet across, and it's 113 stones. That's right. I took a journal and I wrote all this stuff down. The entrances were once thought to frame the sun rising on the equinox and the solstice. However, it's been revealed later that it's they frame the sun perfectly on quarter days, so May 1st and August 1st. They really don't know exactly what this stone circle was used for. It does seem to have a ritual component because there's actually an earthen mound that predates the stones, that's surrounding the outer circle. Some of the largest stones are there, from, over 3 miles away, which is startling when you consider the size of them. But he made a mention of, he made a mention that there had been a psychic in the circle at one point who claimed that she had a vision of a druidic sacrifice there, and pointed to a very specific spot. And honestly, like, there's a strange vibe in there. You know, I'm sure a lot of people want to come around and say, you know, it's all love and light, but there's an odd vibe. The largest stone. It's called the Blackstone. I'm going to murder this. Ronach Krom Dub or something along those lines. It's about 13 feet high, weighs 40 tons.
Wow.
And it's named the Blackstone or the Dark One after the figure in Celtic mythology who brought grain to the people. Which is interesting, you know, to a 14 for a number of reasons. But we're sitting there and we're listening to Michael tell, you know, this very evidence-based story, but then he goes into this psychic story. I'm like, oh, so you're open to these things. I don't say that, but I think to myself, and he goes, have you ever heard of ley lines? And I'm like, brother, you know, have I heard of ley lines? And he says, you know, it's been often rumored that this particular stone circle is a convergence of ley lines, and that he has seen dowsers go in there with their rods and have them just go absolutely nuts. In different directions. And I think that you run into that sort of openness in that amongst, well, at least the older generation in Ireland than you do here. There's a lack of cynicism that I find really startling. I've personally theorized that it's the fact that there are so many people who still walk places in Ireland, you know, that there's, I can't tell you how many people I saw walking along the side of the road, not necessarily in terms of exercise, but in terms of obviously using it as a means of getting from A to B. And I think when you're spending that much time in the countryside, you're opening yourself up to more time in transit, which is a liminal zone, and you have, you know, a chance to interact with things more. Anyway, getting back to Michael, who was both this nice blend of folklore and you know, historical evidence. He said that if you go up to the Blackstone and you press your forehead against it, and you hold your hands out and you try to clear your mind of anything that's, you know, that's weighing heavily on you, that he said, some people say, and he said, I would agree with them, that, that you feel sort of energized. You feel some sort of special sensitivity kindled. And of course, you know me. Like I'm all about wanting something to happen to me. I'm skeptical mm-hmm. enough that if something doesn't happen, or if there's a chance that it wasn't something weird, I don't think that, you know, I would lie to myself. So I'm like, okay, let's try this. So I go over there and I try this, and it doesn't happen. But as we were talking about before the show, you know, among other things, I'm a hypochondriac and I'm a worrywart. So getting my mind to clear is something that's a little bit difficult. So I tried it again. And I gave it a little bit more time. And it was pretty odd now that I look back on it. And I wish I didn't have the reaction that I did. And I certainly wish I didn't have the reaction twice in a row, because I did it again when I was there at night and I had the same reaction. There was a sensation that my forehead was becoming a bit slippery, followed by a sensation of beginning to fall forward, almost, you know, into the rock. I was talking with Tim Banal about this, and he put it a good way. It's almost like, you know, that feeling when you're about to have a really great night of sleep and you actually physically feel yourself starting to fall backwards almost. Mm-hmm. It was like that, standing up, falling forward in the middle of, you know, in the middle of a field. And of course, you know, instead of just embracing that, I pushed back and I was just, you know,
of course.
a little bit flabbergasted. Yeah. And, you know, about that time, because Michael made it a point, he's like, you need to spend about 10 or 15 minutes, just the two of you in this stone circle by yourselves and see what you feel, which I'm in love with the idea that he was willing to, you know, give us that time without me even mentioning, because that's exactly the sort of experience that I was looking for. And I came back up to him before we got in our cars and he said, did you do it? And I said, well, I said, you know, I did. Do you feel anything? And I told him, you know, exactly what I told y'all. And he goes, yep. It's starting. I didn't press him on it at all. So anyway, I went back there that night to try it again, you know, in the middle of the night. Well, I guess 10 p.m. is not really the middle of the night, but you get the idea. Did it in the middle of the night, and I had the same reaction. Same thing happened to me, feeling like I'm falling forward, but also have the same reaction where I'm just pushing myself off of it. And again, like in hindsight, you know, in the coziness of my house, I kind of wish I'd gone back and done that again. But, you know, so that was the only weirdness that happened to me. I did meet a couple people that had weirdness happen to them. There was a gentleman who swore that before his mother died, he heard the banshee. And Michael himself pointed out a cromlech, which is a, if I'm pronouncing it wrong, I don't know. A cromlech, which is a mound of rock, when these particular rocky outcroppings were popular sites for persecuted Catholics to gather for mass. And they would, you know, be able to see anybody coming, because there was once a time in Ireland where the head of a priest offered a pretty sum. Mm. And he mentioned, he said, now he says, I tell this to people and they ask me how I know. And I say, I believe this. He says, I know because I've been there. He says, there is a passageway in there. And if you go into the passageway and you touch the rock in the right spot, you can see a pathway leading down. And at the bottom of that pathway is the most beautiful little chapel you've ever seen. But you have to touch the rock in a certain way, and you have to look at a certain spot. And here I am standing, you know, about half a mile away going, let's go!
You know, yeah.
But there's this 80-year-old guy, and it's over, like, these, you know, a couple of hills and a couple of stone fences that you have to jump. So I knew he wasn't up for it. I, on the other hand, was up for anything like that. Like, as I think I mentioned on Facebook, there was some light trespassing involved to get to some of my fairy mounds, including having to straddle an electric fence that I didn't realize was electric until my way back.
Oh, did you get a nice surprise?
The good news is, and I found this out, if the voltage is low enough and you're wearing denim, it doesn't really seem to affect you. So at least I did get a nice surprise, but not, you know, between my legs. I did make the mistake of wrapping my hand around it on the way back and got a little bit of a jolt. Mm. So yeah, I dodged cow crap and electric fences and jumped a fence and, you know, did some light trespassing. To see some of these things, but you know, it was very much worth it, and I was, you know, try to be as respectful as I could. There was this odd trend that I noticed where I would ask locals about ring forts or about, you know, certain fairy things, and they'd always go, "Oh yeah, there are plenty of ring forts around. Why, over in so and so they have plenty of them. But can I direct you to this particular tourist attraction where you can go?" And I'm like, I'll always be like, "Yeah, thanks, I appreciate it, but, you know, I never said this, but I'm just thinking to myself, I want to get, you know, into the nitty gritty." Because they would invariably tell me about, like, the history of ring forts. I'm like, that's very informative. I kind of know this already, but thank you. Sure. But then, like, literally, in this case of the first one, I had this guy, like, point me, you know, mention something. You know, I said, is there a ring fort around here? Oh, yeah, I think there might be, but I don't know if you can get to it. But there's, you know, you go up to the burn, and you need to go see, you know, Pulnerburn. That's a wonderful, you know, megalithic tomb. And I'm like, that's not what I'm necessarily talking about. And literally, like, I don't know, maybe 100 yards down the road, we find a turnoff, and there's this perfect, you know, immaculately preserved ring fort sitting in the middle of a field, and we pull over the car, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, that must be the ring fort. And he goes, oh, I suppose so. as if he didn't just, you know, walk by it. I found that sort of odd. It was almost like some of them were trying to get me to not go to some of the ring forts. I don't know if there's anything to that, you know. But it was just an interesting little moment that I noticed.
Hmm. So what about the idea when you were talking to the locals, you know, did you get some kind of like impression of just how prevalent the belief in fairies is still in Ireland? Particularly, I would like to be interested. I'm sure that people the age of Michael will still, you know, probably more believing about fairies that, you know, people of our age or even younger.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't think that there's probably, I think that you could, well, you know, it was interesting. Michael talked about, there was a one story that he related to me about that stone circle where, supposedly a wannabe musician, mm, grabbed a harp and slept in the stone circle overnight. And the legend was that the fae folk taught him how to play the harp in a beautiful way after that, which I thought was sort of, you know, reminiscent of, you know, the Robert Johnson, you know, being at the crossroads, having the devil teach you how to play guitar sort of thing. So I think that, you know, someone like Michael would be very much on board with that. I did meet a couple of people from the older generation who said that, even amongst people of middle age, you'll still find some who say, you know, I don't believe in fairies, but they exist. Or say or say things like, you know, yeah, fairies are nonsense, but I'm not going to go into the ring for it for any amount of money. In terms of the young people, I never really got a clear sense for how prevalent or non-prevalent it is. I would imagine that it's not very much talked about at all. At the same time, you know, whenever I go places like this, I will make people know that I'm interested in these things, but I'm not going to press them on it. You know, for a variety of reasons. You know, it might be that, you know, well, for example, I spent some time in someone's castle that was just an incredibly haunted castle that I wrote about in The Brimstone Deceit, and I made mention of, you know, I obliquely made mention of some of the more important and obscure events there, and it was very clear that he understood what I was talking about. But, you know, I'm standing in his home. I'm not going to ask, you know, I'm not going to be the nerdy American saying, you know, tell me all about the ghost stories. So, you know, there are a couple of people that I'd mentioned things to, and it was, they'd make mention of it. I think that honestly, there is some sense that, you know, when you've got that many ring forts around, I think that they're almost sort of become blasé about it, because, yeah, I'm sure that, you know, almost like the tar pits in LA with Greg, you know, why do you want to see the tar pits? You know, why do you want to see, for anybody who doesn't know, at Paramania this past April, Greg was jokingly giving us all grief about wanting to see the La Brea tar pits, because to him, as someone who's grown up in LA, like he's seen it 1,000 times, he's been on field trips there. So I get that sense from a lot of the people there that, you know, that this is something that's woven into their history and the fabric of the landscape. And yeah, you see a fairy fort and you probably, you know, don't go out of your way, to bother it. If for nothing else, out of respect, you know, for ancient history, but yeah, I get the sense that they are sort of a little bit desensitized to it, which I don't know really what I was expecting. I guess that makes perfect sense. Because I, for example, first ring fort I went to, I was talking to a bookstore owner who, you know, by the time we started talking about, you know, where we were from, I found out that she was from Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Which is funny because she started out with a brogue and then she slowly you know, you could hear the North Woods creeping back in. Yeah, it was great. She had come over there and met her husband over there and opened up a bookstore. And I showed her the ring fort, and she was like, oh yeah, it's exactly what that is. She's like, my husband has some on his property too. it's just like, if that were me, like, I'd be out there, you know, every night I'd be setting up cameras and hanging out there. But I think that it's just a part of daily life. And I don't think that they think about it necessarily as being all that special, which, you know, if I'd grow up there, I probably wouldn't either.
Well, also look at how many there are. Like, I'm shocked there's that many of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's startling. And like I said, I heard it from numerous different sources, numerous printed sources and numerous, you know, tourist sources, that 40 to 60,000 somewhere in there. But even if it's at the low end of that, you know, I mean, heck, even if it's 40,000, that's a ton of ring forts.
Yeah. And why keep building them is my question.
Yeah.
I think that's a great question. I'm sure that there is some sort of professor, or again, some sort of enterprising grad student who would have a great answer for that. I really don't know. I think that one of the easiest answers probably is that they did serve different purposes. I think that some were, you know, dwellings, and some were ritual spaces, and some were, you know, livestock corrals. But the exact nature of each one is a bit lost to time.
Were you going to say something, Red Pill?
Yeah, two things. Did you get a chance to see one of those cool stones with those, you know, spirals or carved?
Did I? So, I made our first full day there. I only cried 4 times, so that's good. on the entire trip, but one of the times that I cried was at Brenneboyne, which is an incredibly important burial mound site. I didn't make a video there, now that I think about it. Should have. But it is extremely important for several reasons. For example, one of the most intact Neolithic artifacts was found there. The second site that's at New Grange is actually called Nauth, and it's a very similar site. It is known for its megalithic artwork. And the largest of the mounds is completely surrounded at the bottom by large stones. I'd say probably at least 4 feet, in diameter, that have all sorts of artwork. In fact, this particular site has 30% of all extant megalithic artwork in Western Europe, which I found to be astounding, around this one mound, basically. What I found really interesting was the guide at this particular tourist attraction, or not tourist attraction, historical site, really, said, you'll notice that a lot of these shapes are similar to the shapes that people see in altered states of consciousness, which can be brought about by meditation or other means. I was like, drugs. The specific shapes that you see on these, and I don't know if someone has probably put this together, and I probably have put it together at some point in the past. It was quite interesting to see that the shapes were all zigzags, sort of snake shapes, concentric circles, spirals, chevrons, triangles, and diamonds. And those are things that you see under altered states. But for some reason, I guess somebody had put this together at some point. But those are all classic UFO shapes too. Like, you can view the zigzag thing as the falling leaf. Concentric circles can be viewed as like almost like a mandala, chevrons, triangles, etc.
Yeah.
I thought that was particularly interesting. That site, I bet, is something to behold at night as well. I've heard stories about there being fairy lights around there. Unfortunately, I did not get to see them because the site closes after dark. And besides, that was the day that we went all around Northern Ireland. Like, it was quite a day of running around from Belfast up to... that was the day before. Anyway, we had places to go. We had, had to see some castles too.
Sure.
But it was really impressive. One of the other impressive sites that really made an impression on me was the Hill of Knocknaree. And Knocknaree is I think you can justifiably say it's a mountain. It's a small mountain, but it's a mountain. Where there's a large cairn at the top. This is another sort of structure that's been conflated with the fairies as well. This large cairn is said to be the resting home of Queen Mab, with the fairy queen. So my wife and I, after seeing the Giant's Causeway and Bush Mills and Dunluce Castle and like all this stuff, we finally get to Sligo, which is where this is, at about 5:30. And I had no idea, but I thought that the burial mound was in the middle of a field, and that's before I realized that Knock means hill. So we get there at 5:30. And I look at this mountain, and my wife said, "I thought you said you weren't going to go to the top." And I said, "I wasn't going to go to the top of the burial mound, but the burial mound's on the top of the mountain." So to get to the foot of this thing, you have to walk about 10 minutes through this field. I'll be sure to post some pictures. I keep on saying this to everybody, and I still haven't done it yet. Because my life's a little bit crazy right now. But once things calm down a little bit, I will post pictures, because it's the most Irish thing I've ever done. Because you're walking through this field. You're literally walking through a cow field. There's a rugged fence on one side. The other side is a fence of stacked stone. Right there we were doing this entire thing during the golden hour, which was just a striking striking time to be doing this. And we get to the bottom of the hill, and you've got to, you know, that's where the fence stops, and you're literally walking through, you know, a sheep and cow pasture. You're having to dodge cow pies. And we got to the top, and it was the most incredible view. The sun was setting, and there's this, you know, very obviously, again, a primitive human site, but it's a primitive human site that's been conflated with the fairies, and it was an incredible time to be there. And I have a great video from the top that doesn't even come close to doing the view justice, but it does sort of catch the vibe because all the wind stopped and it became very quiet. In fact, somebody that we met on the way down said how odd that it was, because usually at the top you're being buffeted by wind the entire time. But I did my part. I did my part because if you take a rock off of the cairn, you'll be cursed. But if you, you know, add rocks to the cairn, you'll be blessed. So I made sure I did that and did my part. And then we came back down. But it was just, even though it was a daunting thing to do at first, the timing of it was absolutely perfect. And again, I personally got a sense that it's not a huge tourist attraction, probably because it involves climbing, but also because, you know, I don't get the sense that a lot of people have as deep an appreciation for this ancient history as, you know, for example, the three of us, or, you know, the listeners or the other roundtable members on this show would. Because you know, everybody, the handful of people, I think we saw like four or five handful of people that we met were all locals. But I think if you are someone who is even remotely interested in any of this ancient history, do it, because it actually makes for a pretty darn cheap trip to Ireland. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you're going to be interested in, for me, a lot of it's not even, you know, marked. But even if you are interested in seeing the stuff that's marked, it's either free or it's, you know, incredibly cheap. You know, I got to sit down in a haunted castle that I wrote about in one of my books with the owner of the castle in front of the fire while I played his penny whistle for €6. You know, which is just, you know, for that sort of experience for me, you know, I would have paid maybe three or four or five times that just to have that experience.
Did you get a chance to visit Ben Bulwin?
Did not. I drove by it. That's another one of those sites where they have seen fairy lights racing to the top of it. I really wish that we had. I remember it's in that sort of Yates country, which is like a fairy rich, fairy dense country. But we had to get to our check-in at the bed and breakfast in Dingle, and so we had to sort of rush by it. So I did see it, you know, from afar, and I recognized the church where Yates is buried. So as it went by, I took a picture, took a quick picture as we drove by it, you know, 60 miles an hour. But didn't get to go to Ben Bulwin. I mean, I have to go back just to make up for the few things that, you know, I didn't get to see, because there's a wealth of stuff that I didn't even touch.
So how has this changed your view of all this stuff?
It's solidified something that I've been flirting with for a while, which is that the very, at least in popular culture, underemphasized relationship between the fae folk and the dead is a absolute key component of trying to understand what sort of an objective reality lies behind us. I mean, the fact that all the fairy sites are very obviously of human construction. There's nothing, I mean, there's something mystical about them, but there's a certain level of mystery that's just not there. Seeing the way that the fairy lore ties in with the dead makes me think that that's a key component, much in the same way that, you know, Anne Streber told Whitley, this has something to do with death.
Right.
This has something to do with death. Right now, if you had to hold my feet to the fire, I think we're dealing with, you know, because for anybody who doesn't know, the only bit of pop culture that I've seen that really connects the fairy folk to the dead has been Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which has basically fairies taking the dead or those in trances to the to fairyland and sort of cavorting with them. But you'll find in all sorts of stories and folklore and collected folklore that people will see dead neighbors. Oftentimes the dead neighbors are the ones that warn them not to eat or drink in Fairyland. Or people will see, you know, entire generations of family members sitting in these fairy wraths, these fairy mounds. And like I said, that was just really underscored, just seeing how ancient the history of habitation was and how these sites are very definitely man-made, but there's some sort of weird blurring or blending of the lines here. So if I had to commit to exactly what's going on here, I've come to the impression that the fairy faith represents partially the spirits of the dead and partially basically psychopomps. Intercessing spirits that sort of facilitate communication between the living and the dead, and might be the souls of the dead transformed into something, and might be discrete souls that have never walked the earth, discrete spirits rather that have never walked the earth, and possibly, you know, something else vague in between. But the component of the dead is 100% one of the most important things about fairy lore that I don't think anybody talks about.
All right.
Here's another question. Obviously, you came to Ireland with a whole lot of knowledge already, you know, in your belt. Did you manage to learn something new during the trip? So something that you actually surprised you?
Yeah. I mean, some little factoids. Like, for example, one of the remedies that I was aware of for disposing of, or for, you know, recovering your child if it was a changeling was suspected, was to throw the changeling on the dung heap. And for the longest time I was sort of wondering, well, why are there dung heaps outside of every home? But I found out that it was partially due to the fact that the family would actually bring sometimes in some cases livestock into the home, not only to provide to keep the livestock alive, but to provide warmth in the winter, an extra bit of warmth. But they would take the leavings, to put it politely, they would take the leavings of the livestock and they would pile it outside the door to be fertilized in the next year's planting of the field. So little things like that sort of helped me, again, contextualize things. Probably the most tantalizing thing that I looked up, and I've got to, or that not that I looked up, but that I heard. And I've got to look this up. I have not looked this up yet, but I think it's at least a blog post, if not something more, because it's such a fascinating idea. There are apparently there is a rumor going around that the reason that the DeLorean failed is because, as you know, as a company, is because of the bad luck that was accrued when the company built its headquarters outside Belfast, and they actually tore down a fairy tree, and that set them on the path to bad luck that ended up making the company go bankrupt. I have no idea if there's a basis about it. I've just done some very cursory investigation on the internet, and that's a story that's been kicked around a lot. But I heard it from someone there, so that makes me think there might be some actual truth to it. So that was a nice little thread to pull on for the future.
Interesting. I'm not sure if I have any other questions beyond what you've already covered.
Well, you know, I thanks for, you know, having me talk. I feel a bit sheepish. I feel like I'm that person that has to show you, oh, look, the slides of when we were in the Caribbean. Look, it's so beautiful. Look.
Hey, sometimes slides are interesting.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Fair enough. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that really should be addressed. So we talked about Loch Gur and all the fairy mounds and the fairy forts.
Did you see any fairy lights the entire time you were there?
That's why I went out at 10 at you know, in the middle of the night and didn't see anything. Not a thing.
Okay. I didn't think so.
You know, I'll tell you another insight though, Red, that has really stuck with me is I feel like a lot of us, or maybe this is just me, but I feel like a lot of us in the States feel like you have to get away from everything to see where the weirdness hangs out, right? You know, you have to in order to have a, you know, a truly unexplained experience, it helps to be far away from civilization. And it was quite inspiring to me, the fact that you can be in a field in Ireland, and in any given field, unless you're on something that's a specific nature preserve or something, you will see civilization. It's not like some parts of America where you can go and not see civilization. You will see some sort of, you know, light from a home, or, you know, you're never very far from some sort of settlement. And it occurred to me that if this can be a place that is so saturated with fairy lore that's happening through today, I found in one of the bed and breakfasts, I found a really interesting story in a book that was collected by Michael that we had the tour with, about a person who was walking between fields after a dance and saw a luminous light come out of a pasture. And as it turns out, the next day, the gentleman who owned that land was found dead. So this stuff is still seen today, and it's still seen today in a place that's, you know, very well inhabited, in a small place. So I guess what it really sort of underscored to me was the fact that you don't have to be isolated for these the unexplained to touch you, and these things are woven into the fabric of every bit of land, regardless of whether or not there's a Walmart there or you're in the middle of nowhere. And that was really inspiring to me in a lot of ways, because that's, you know, as someone who is in desperate need to have their world re-enchanted a bit, it's been too long since I've had something truly, truly unambiguously anomalous happen to me. That was a real inspiration.
Well, one thing that I learned when reading the classic book by Evan Wentz, you know, the Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries, you know, two ideas that he repeats all through the book is, one, the belief by the Celtic peasants, the farmers, that fairies were seen more frequently, like prior to the Industrial Revolution, but then kind of like they started to be seen less frequently when the cities of men started to kind of like invade their territories, right? So that's one idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is the idea that, yeah, there are people who can still see the fairies, but it's not like every, you know, anyone can do it. It's like a psychics or someone with kind of like I think that even he calls it the fairy sight, you know. So people with greater sense of intuition that are able to see into these, you know, liminal realms.
It's that frustrating thing that you'll hear all the time where, you know, you don't see fairies with your eyes, you see them with your heart. And it's like, come on, guys. You know, I don't disbelieve that, but I won't want to believe that something else is, you know, it's possible. So
this is an important question, Josh. How do we know it's still you?
Oh, and not a changeling?
Right.
Exactly.
Well, I am in a better mood and I am more awake than I have been on previous episodes, so maybe you should be worried. Maybe you should be worried. You know, in regards to Miguel's other point about sort of, you know, the exodus of the fairies, as it's been talked about, I mean, that's that particular, I mean, he's totally right. And you will find that the reason for the fairies leaving the fairyland has been attributed to, you know, the church. It's been attributed to overdevelopment. It's been attributed to the Industrial Revolution, all of these things. The church, specifically Protestantism, because Catholicism actually kind of had a place for these spirits, but you will find that motif of the fairies leaving our mortal realm all the way back in the Canterbury Tales, and it's continued ever since. And, you know, interestingly enough, people who have had actual sightings of little people have sometimes reported them leaving very sullenly from their you know, their fairy mounds, and you know, with all their belongings, and leaving on tiny little horses. And I really don't know what I do have more to say about that metaphor, but it's going to come out in my book. But for right now, I'll paraphrase the great Patrick Harper, who I think very presciently pointed out that the fairies are always going, but never gone. And if we are to believe the UFO community, the aliens are always coming, but never here. And I think that's an incredibly insightful, incredibly insightful angle on it.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, I read that and my jaw dropped because it's one of the most insightful comparisons between the two that I've heard.
Patrick Harper, who incidentally now has two new books out, both of them fiction.
Yeah, I have not had a chance to read the fiction one yet. I really want to. Yes. It's just been whenever I'm writing a book, which I just got finished with the edits on book number three, the last thing that I want to do is crack open a book.
Well, we're going to check out his new stuff, and then we're going to bring him on for a roundtable to talk about it.
Yes, that would be excellent. I'd love to be a part of that.
And we've now won Timothy Renner over on the brilliance of Patrick Harper as well.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I remember way back when I first wrote Trojan Feast, I spoke up to the Georgia chapter of MUFON, and there was a gentleman there. No, I'm sorry, I got this completely wrong. I was on the Higher Side chats, and there was a gentleman from Atlanta here. Who was with the Young Society of Atlanta, and he said, you know, I really like your thoughts. Would you like to come speak at the Young Society? I'm like, that would be great. And flash forward to 2 years later, he finally asks me, and in the interim, I've read Patrick Harper, and I'm like, I have nothing to add, you know. Fine, then I'll come speak. I'm going to come and read the Daemonic Reality for 5 hours.
All right. Also, Josh, you had recommended, I think, on the air, if not at least to me, we're going to mention on the air now, a movie called The Dark Song.
Yes.
And that was a brilliant movie.
Oh, so you saw it. You enjoyed it?
I did.
Yeah, I know some friends of mine who are magically inclined who have some nits to pick, but I think But I think in terms of representing what magical practice is and the way that things happen and the way that these things unfold, I think it's the truest depiction of it. It reminds me a lot of, like, for example, the Mothman prophecies. That isn't an exact telling of the events, but it captures that feel of what it's like. It's a great encapsulation of Fortiana. This is a great encapsulation of magical practice as I understand it.
Right.
There's that great moment where this is not much of a spoiler, anybody, but if you really are averse, skip forward 15 seconds or something. There's a moment where the ritual begins to work, and you know, all they start hearing is a knock, and he says, "You've got their attention now." You know, that's exactly, from everything that I understand, that's exactly the way all that goes down. And I thought the ending was handled really well in terms of, you know, being ambiguous enough, and it's a horror film with an uplifting message. I'm pretty smitten with the entire project.
Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic.
So, Red Pill, get on it.
Check it out. It's not on Netflix, right?
It is on Netflix.
Yeah.
Oh,
but I don't know if there's some sort of region restriction, but yes, it is on Netflix. Probably.
All right.
Well worth the time. It is a little slow. People should be warned.
Oh, but it is so good once it gets going.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it does take a while to get going. Yeah. So if you're expecting jump scares and stuff that kick off right from the beginning, you're not going to like this movie. All right. So, Josh, you have a new book coming out?
Yes, I literally haven't even submitted it to my publisher yet. Right now, I've just finished I've written it, and then I've reread it and done my first round of edits. I will be I will be sending it to some readers to get their input as well and make sure I didn't say anything too stupid or that there isn't some sort of giant section that I should cut out. But I plan on having it to my publisher by the end of the year, and it will be released sometime in 2018. So it is on the schedule for Anomalous Books 2018 releases. I just got to sort out the details right now.
Nice. Okay. Red, and where can people find you in general?
Oh, me? I thought you said Red.
Yes. Sorry, I was going to, and then I realized you didn't give out your website.
No, that's okay. It's joshuacutchin.com. I have every intention of being better about blogging. I feel like I say a variation of this every time I plug it. I have every intention of being a better blogger than I am right now. But at the very least, you can find links to the books, a couple of blogs that I'm quite proud of, and a list of every interview, which I need to update. It's a couple months behind, but that shouldn't take too much time. A list of every interview that I have been on, in case you want to, you know, drive yourself insane by listening to me for 3 days straight.
Nice. And Red Pill, where can people find you?
Well, mainly at the Daily Grail, which is, you know, my main home on the interwebs. And by the way, Greb has just launched a new major redesign of the web page. It looks gorgeous, and it's and it handles really well on all you know, wireless devices. So you will be able to now enjoy the content of the Daily Grail on your phone and your tablet. You know, and it really looks great. So please do take the time to go and visit it. Also, obviously, I write semi-regularly for Mysterious Universe. I actually have written more for Mysterious Universe this year than, I guess, in the last two or three. The last article I wrote was, curiously enough, about Fatima. I guess Adam Sain, you know, gave me the idea. I was, yeah, you know, it's the 100th anniversary of the Miracle of the Sun. Was last week, so I might as well, you know, write something about, you know, one of the most least discussed aspects of the whole Marian apparitions. And then there's, you know, I also have my Facebook page, Red Pill Junkie. I have my Twitter account, and I have my own webpage, absurdbydesign.com, which is kind of like Josh said, you know. It's there. It's not. It hasn't a lot of fresh content, but you know, it's, you can reach me there, and you can, you know, see things that I have written in the past.
And everyone should read that that Fatima piece. It's great. It's great, RPG.
Oh, thanks, man.
All right, thank you both. All right, and to take you out, we're gonna go with some Psyche Corporation. Something I've never played before, despite all the shows on the Fae and stuff that we've done. It's a very early Psyche Corporation song. It's called Fairy's Deal. Because, you know, seems appropriate, right? See you next time.
To know what you would sacrifice to me. dawning. I will be here till the end. You are fragile as the lotus. I could crush you in my hand. So why do you still dare to kneel and beg of me a fairy's deal? Hide your dread. You will harvest fear distilled till the chalice has its fill. And remember when you pause the dream that holds you in her claws. Tear your bones away from flesh. To petition for divine grace. You've always wanted too much. I can give you what you seek, but I'm no kindly sort of greed. And I demand to know what you would sacrifice to me. Sacrifice to me. I have been here since the dawning. I will be here till the end. You are fragile as the lotus. I could crush you in my hand. So why do you still dare to kneel? Sparks, there I find you dancing.